support and defend the Constitution of the United States. The Constitution charged Congress as representatives of the people with the responsibility to decide whether to declare war. The American people, through their representatives in Congress, were to determine whether South Vietnam's freedom and independence was worth the costs and risks. With the exception of Green, and then only in private to a staff member, the chiefs had decided to support their commander-in-chief by misrepresenting their own estimates of the situation in Vietnam. Green felt keenly the tension between loyalty to the president and his responsibilities to the American people, and had chosen a middle course of publicly supporting the administration while privately providing his actual views to the Congress. The chief's obligations to their soldiers, airmen, sailors, and Marines complicated already conflicting responsibilities. As American involvement in the war deepened, Lyndon Johnson remained determined to depict the war very differently from the way that Green had described it. Johnson would need congressional approval to mobilize reserves and to obtain additional funds to finance the war. Mobilization, or a request for funds, however, would have sparked an enormous controversy over Vietnam that might have led representatives to conclude that the country could not afford both guns and butter. Presidential aide Jack Valenti recalled that in July 1965, the president was in the middle of the biggest legislative fight of Johnson's history. Although he knew that financing the deployments that he had already decided to approve would cost approximately $8 billion in fiscal year 1966, the president thought it impossible for him to submit to Congress before January 1966 a supplementary budget request of more than $300 or $400 million. Intent on obscuring the cost of the war from the body that held constitutional authority over appropriations and declaring war, the president directed Vance to have the Defense Department ready to explain to Congress that no additional funds were needed until January, at which time they would be able to come up with clear and precise figures as to what is required. Separately, McNamara suggested that to avoid inflation, the president financed the war through additional taxation. Alluding to the difficulty of getting Congress to approve additional taxes for a war that had not gained enthusiastic public support, Johnson told McNamara to get your ass up to the hill and don't come back until you have the vote count. The president feared that a tax bill would sap the momentum behind his domestic legislation. He told McNamara, "God damn it, Bob, how many times do I have to remind you that after FDR tried to pack the Supreme Court and failed, he couldn't get Congress to pass the time of day?" After finding that the votes were not there, McNamara dropped his recommendation. LBJ recognized, however, that placing limits on the use of force in time of war because of domestic political concerns would incite controversy and opposition. Valenti observed that the last thing that Lyndon Johnson wanted was to make public his strategy about the Great Society and the war. He wasn't going to do it. There's no question that he wanted to sotto voce the whole thing. On July 19th, McGeorge Bundy showed the president a draft memo intended for key senators arguing that deeper U.S. involvement in Vietnam did not require additional appropriations. He included the observation that it would create the impression that we have to have guns, not butter, and would help the enemies of the president's domestic legislative program. Johnson ordered Bundy to rewrite the memo, eliminating the reference to the Great Society. It was clear to Bundy that the president would never admit that the Great Society shaped his Vietnam decisions because he would have thought that going around advertising that you're adjusting your public words to the nature of your legislative program suggested you didn't deserve to be in charge of the legislative program. While concern over an escalation of the war was genuine, Johnson exaggerated the danger of Chinese intervention to justify his unwillingness to ask congressional approval of measures that might jeopardize his domestic legislation. With McNamara's assistance, he contrived rationalizations that mobilization alone might provoke an escalation of the war, and that a sharp congressional debate over appropriations risked sending the wrong signal to Hanoi about American resolve. Between July 21st and 27th, Johnson held a series of meetings to diffuse potential opposition to his Vietnam decisions. The JCS and the service secretaries met with the president on July 22nd. If the chiefs found limitations on the level of force under McNamara's option unsatisfactory, the other options the president presented, bugging out and maintain present force and losing slowly, were even more unpalatable to them. The president amplified his concern that if he gave Westmoreland all he asked for and expanded the air campaign in accord with JCS advice, China might come in. He told the chiefs that there are millions of Chinese. I think they're going to put their stack in. McNamara assisted the president by restricting discussion to the three alternative courses of action under consideration. As the meeting convened, he told the president that the JCS had only a short time to review his paper and were unprepared to discuss the requirements for a reserve call-up or budgetary matters, the matters about which the president was most concerned. Green did not abide by McNamara's ground rules. The Marine commandant began speaking softly. The president told Green, "I don't have a hearing aid." Green responded, "Well, Mr. President, I'll speak louder and make sure that you and everyone else in this room hears what I have to say." McNamara was visibly upset as Green expressed frustration over limitations on military force. He urged intensifying Rolling Thunder, blockading North Vietnam, and mining Haiphong Harbor. He told the president that winning the war in South Vietnam would take 5 years and 500,000 soldiers and Marines. Ignoring Green's estimate, the president continued to use the fear of escalation to parry JCS calls for more resolute military action. After Green recommended the deployment of 80,000 more Marines than Westmoreland had requested, the president asked, "Won't this cause them, China and the Soviet Union, to come in?" When Harold Johnson responded, "No, I don't think they will," the president reminded him that MacArthur didn't think they would come in either. After reviewing his handwritten notes of July 1965, McGeorge Bundy recalled that although the president emphasized a concern over an escalation of the war, his unspoken object was to protect his legislative program. All the chiefs, except Green, suppressed their misgivings about the president's plans to deepen slowly American involvement in the war and focused on the global political imperative of containing communism. MacDonald observed that the United States can't win an all-out war, but thought that a loss of international credibility that would attend a U.S. withdrawal left the United States with no choice but to send more troops. He offered weakly that the increase in the U.S. military effort would allow the United States to do better than we're doing. There was virtually no discussion of how the additional troops would be employed or how their actions might contribute to achieving policy goals. Although Green made one final plea for consideration of the enclave strategy, his challenge to Westmoreland's concept of seeking out and destroying the enemy sparked no debate. Wheeler made several references to the stated policy goal of maintaining South Vietnam as free and independent, but there was no attempt to reconcile that goal with McNamara's proposal that military force should aim to achieve a stalemate in the South. The shallowness of the discussion probably pleased LBJ. Harold Brown, who had attended the meeting as the nominee to replace Eugene Zuckert as Secretary of the Air Force, recalled that the president's principal concern was to get all of his advisors on the record in support of his decisions. At the president's request, McGeorge Bundy summarized the arguments that Defense Department officials and the JCS might face in Congress. For 10 years, every step we have taken has been based on a previous failure. All we have done has failed and caused us to take another step, which failed. As we get further into the bag, we get deeply bruised. Also, we have made excessive claims we haven't been able to realize. Also, after 20 years of warning about a war in Asia, we are now doing what MacArthur and others have warned against. We are about to fight a war we can't fight and win. The country we are trying to help is quitting. The failure on our own to fully realize what guerrilla war is like. We are sending conventional troops to do an unconventional job. How long? How much? Can we take casualties over 5 years? Aren't we talking about a military solution when the solution is political? Why can't we interdict better? Why are our bombings so fruitless? Why can't we blockade the coast? Why can't we improve our intelligence? Why can't we find the Viet Cong? Bundy had assembled an impressive overview of the arguments against intervention. The purpose of his observations, however, was not to generate discussion, but to prepare the JCS and top civilian officials in the Department of Defense to defend the course on which the president had already decided. At the conclusion of the meeting, LBJ told the JCS and the service secretaries that "we are going to get all kinds of criticism," and expressed his expectation that they support him in the difficult period ahead. Although McNamara had placed the issues of appropriations and mobilization essentially off limits, the president seemed to be preparing the chiefs for a decision against mobilization of reserves. As in the past, Johnson played for their sympathy. He suggested that presenting the war to Americans in stark terms would make him vulnerable to congressional and public criticism. He said, "If I were to do this, mothers would come out of their pantries and take their aprons off." He told the JCS that a full disclosure of his plans to deepen American involvement in the war would incite opposition and make him a lonely man. Although McNamara initially favored mobilization, he told LBJ that he was not pressing him to make that decision. McNamara's determination to give the president what he wanted soon overwhelmed his early inclination. Although he allowed the chiefs to continue planning based on the assumption that reserves would mobilize, McNamara told the president that mobilization was unnecessary and assured Johnson that he could fight the war without it. By Friday night, July 23rd, it had finally become clear to the JCS that the president's domestic political priorities had overwhelmed the assumptions on which they had based Vietnam planning. Late in the evening, Green met with NHTSA in the Secretary of the Navy's office. NHTSA told Green that he had just received new instructions from the Secretary of Defense. Orders from President Johnson were to hold down the political noise level of escalation. Instead of the $12.7 billion that the chiefs estimated the new deployments would cost, the administration would limit additional funding to the $1 billion already included in the 1966 Defense Appropriations Bill. Reserves would not be called up. Green was to plan for the deployment of the 1st Marine Division and Air Wing to South Vietnam, and there would be no replacement for the division in the nation's Strategic Reserve Force. Shocked, the general warned that if the 1st Marine Division and Air Wing were deployed, there would be no strategic reserve left in the United States for other contingencies. McNamara had anticipated Green's objection and had told NHTSA that according to McNamara's systems analysts, the 4th Marine Division, reserve, could be mobilized in 2 weeks instead of the Marine Corps planning factor of 90 days. Green was incredulous. He told NHTSA that the United States was on the verge of escalating the South Vietnam emergency into a full-scale war, and that the failure to treat it as such was a grave error. The reserves should be called up, and the full supplemental budget required should be asked of Congress. NHTSA replied that the reason for keeping the political noise level low was the fear of antagonizing China or the Soviet Union. Green recognized, however, that the real reason why this action was proposed was to keep the political noise level down in the United States. NHTSA directed Green to have his plans ready to support the president's decision by 7:30 the next morning. In a meeting with the service secretaries and the JCS at noon on Saturday, July 24th, McNamara outlined his plan to meet Westmoreland's request without mobilization and without asking Congress for sufficient funding to carry it out. Mobilization, extension of tours of duty for those already in the services, and supplemental funding would all require legislative action and were, therefore, rejected. The president would delay all funding requests until January 1966, and then the need would be understated by half. McNamara told the chiefs that the program was designed to reduce the political noise level in Communist China and the Soviet Union. McDonald challenged him immediately, asserting that the decision was based more on the domestic political noise level than on international considerations. McNamara smiled at the admiral and admitted that mobilization of the reserves would cause a serious domestic debate, quickly modifying his exaggerated concern over an escalation of the war. McNamara insisted that such a congressional debate would give the communists a wrong impression of U.S. resolve. 30 years later, McNamara admitted that the Great Society had dominated the president's desire to conceal the cost and scale of American intervention in Vietnam. To prevent potential opposition, McNamara promised the chiefs that the country would take more resolute action in the future and appealed to service interests. As with other denials of JCS recommendations, McNamara promised that the president would reconsider the decision against mobilization at a later time. McNamara asked Green whether he would support the deployment plan if the size of Marine deployments in 1966 increased and the ceiling on the size of the Marine Corps was lifted. Green, as he had in the past, went along with the administration in exchange for decisions that benefited the Corps. Harold Johnson also went along with the president's decision, even though he knew that the failure to mobilize was a prescription for disaster, both for his service and for the war. He also recognized that the decision to obscure the cost of the war was based on the president's desire to keep Vietnam very, very low-key, in favor of Great Society legislation. General Johnson recalled, however, that the decision left him tongue-tied. All he could do was tell McNamara that the quality of the Army is going to erode to some degree that we can't assess now. Years afterward, General Johnson asked, "What should my role have been? I'm a dumb soldier under civilian control. I could resign, and what am I? I'm a disgruntled general for 48 hours, and then I'm out of sight, right?" Although the general thought that fighting a war while adhering to peacetime practices was unconscionable and recognized that our self-imposed restraints exceeded by far the objectives we sought, he did not resign, resist, or object to the president's decision. Appointed by the president to a position that he never expected to achieve, Johnson was willing to stay on and try and fight and get the best posture that we can. He was to preside over the disintegration of the Army, a disintegration that began with the president's decision against mobilization. Harold Johnson's inaction haunted him for the rest of his life. The president, however, expected more than acquiescence from the JCS and Wheeler in particular. He needed Wheeler's support to deceive the Congress about the nature and cost of American intervention in Vietnam. The disparity between the truth and what the president was willing to tell Congress and the American people would have made Johnson's administration particularly vulnerable to the defection of an uncompromising general. On the evening of July 27th, before he made public his decision, President Johnson made one last effort to soften up his own National Security Council and selected members of Congress. During the NSC meeting, the president outlined five choices. 1. Use our massive power, including Strategic Air Command, to bring the enemy to his knees. Less than 10% of our people urge this course of action. 2. We could get out on the grounds that we don't belong there. Not very many people feel this way about Vietnam. Most feel that our national honor is at stake and that we must keep our commitments there. Ike, Kennedy, and I have given a commitment. 3. We could keep our forces at the present level, approximately 80,000 men, but suffer the consequences of losing additional territory and of accepting increased casualties. You wouldn't want your boy to be out there and crying for help and not get it. 4. We could ask for everything we might desire from Congress. Money, authority to call up the reserves, and acceptance of the deployment of more combat battalions. This dramatic course of action would involve declaring a state of emergency and a request for several billion dollars. Many favored this course. However, if we do go all out in this fashion, Hanoi would be able to ask the Chinese communists and the Soviets to increase aid and add to their existing commitment. For that reason, I don't want to be dramatic and cause tension. I think we can get our people to support us without having to be provocative. 5. We have chosen to do what is necessary to meet the present situation, but not to be unnecessarily provocative to either the Russians or the Communist Chinese. We will give the commanders the men they say they need. We will get the necessary money in the new budget, and will use our transfer authority until January. We will neither brag about what we are doing or thunder at the Chinese communists and the Russians. Johnson announced that we will hold until January. Having portrayed mobilization as dramatic and unnecessarily provocative, he claimed that his chosen course could make a diplomatic solution more likely. When the president asked if anyone in the room opposed the course of action, everyone, including General Earl Wheeler, remained silent. Lyndon Johnson would depend even more heavily on Wheeler's silence during the meeting with the Senate and House leadership that convened 10 minutes later. In the meeting with the senators and representatives, LBJ and McNamara misrepresented the scale of Westmoreland's request, understated the funds they needed by approximately $10 billion, and argued that mobilization, from a military perspective, was not only unnecessary, but undesirable. McNamara understated by half the 100,000 troops that Westmoreland had requested to arrive in South Vietnam by the end of the year. House Republican Whip Leslie Ahrens asked McNamara directly, "General Westmoreland needs how much?" Stating ambiguously that we will meet requirements, McNamara cited an immediate need for 13 battalions and 50,000 men, whom we will ship now as soon as the decision is made. Although he had favored mobilization, McNamara contended that calling up the reserves would be an inefficient use of a perishable asset. Although McNamara's cost estimate of the anticipated deployments was approximately $10 to $12 billion, the president claimed that we have the money. when Senate Minority Leader Dirksen told the president, "If you need the money, you ought to ask for it." Johnson expressed his desire to delay any funding requests until January, after the Great Society legislation passed, and alluded ambiguously to a good sizable supplement of a few billion dollars. Even after he dramatically reduced Westmoreland's request and obscured the cost of the war, LBJ attempted to avoid potential opposition with a plea to support American troops and their commander. He told the representatives that, "Westie wants help, I'm going to give it." McNamara was in top form. He sensed what the legislators wanted to hear and tried to fulfill their expectations. He lied that American troops were not engaged in combat operations and tried to allay fears that the United States was intervening on behalf of a weak client. In response to a question by House Majority Whip Hale Boggs, McNamara stated that the South Vietnamese have demonstrated a willingness to fight, even though they were suffering heavy casualties. Wheeler's presence lent silent support to the president's and the defense secretary's subterfuge. LBJ and McNamara succeeded. With the exception of Senator Mansfield, the only member of Congress present who had voiced opposition to American military intervention in Vietnam, all expressed support. Speaker of the House John McCormick stated that our military men tell us we need more and we should give it to them. McCormick closed the meeting by telling LBJ that he would have united support. This was a historic meeting. The president would have the support of all true Americans. In a brief meeting with the president, after the congressional leadership departed, McNamara told Johnson that he was full of confidence concerning their handling of the senators and representatives. On July 28th, less than 90 minutes before he held his press conference to announce the escalation of the American effort in Vietnam, President Johnson made remarks at a Pentagon cost reduction award ceremony. He highlighted his close relationship with McNamara. "I am indebted to none more, and there is none that I have greater affection or admiration for than the man who ranks you all in this department, the great Secretary of Defense, Bob McNamara. He gave up a great deal of his hobbies and his pleasures and hundreds of thousands of dollars each year and millions of investments to come here and serve his country. He has served it faithfully and well. And if he has made mistakes, they have been mistakes of the head and not of the heart." After he presented awards to employees of the defense establishment for their efforts to reduce costs to the government, Lyndon Johnson recognized General Wheeler in his closing remarks. "I want to publicly thank General Wheeler, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, for his wise counsel during the period that I have been president. There are many honored and hallowed names on the honor roll of the Chiefs of Staff and the chairman of the Chiefs of Staff, but there is none that is greater or has contributed finer service or more wisdom and understanding than the man who now occupies that high office. I would say that I sleep better every night when I sleep because of General Wheeler." After honoring publicly the men who had made possible his deceit and manipulation of Congress and the American people, the president left the Pentagon for the news conference. Just after 12:30, when the television audience would be smallest, Lyndon Johnson walked into the East Room of the White House. Although he understated Westmoreland's request by 75,000 troops, Johnson declared, "I have asked the commanding general, General Westmoreland, what more he needs to meet this mounting aggression. He has told me we will meet his needs." These deployments, the president stated, would increase troop strength from 75,000 to 125,000. Even as he explained that Additional forces will be needed later, and they will be sent as requested. Johnson again denied that forces deployed to Vietnam were already engaged in combat operations. To generate support, however, Johnson suggested that questioning his policy would be tantamount to abandoning the men that are there. Emphasizing continuity between his administration and those of his predecessors, Johnson reassured his audience that his announcement did not imply any change in policy whatever. He claimed that he had not exceeded his executive authority and stated that he had been forthright with Congress. Johnson underplayed the potential costs and consequences of the war. He said that his moderate course would permit the United States to find some solution that would substitute words for bombs. When asked whether North Vietnam would escalate its efforts to match U.S. troop deployments, the president would not speculate on the reactions of other people. When asked how long the war might take, the president was equally unwilling to prophesy or predict. Finally, Johnson cultivated the impression that the deliberations at the end of July had been inclusive and searching. He told the people that he had had lots of callers. The past week of deliberations, Johnson said, had convinced him that mobilization was unnecessary. As American involvement in Vietnam deepened, the gap between the true nature of that commitment and the president's depiction of it to the American people, the Congress, and members of his own administration widened. Lyndon Johnson, with the assistance of Robert S. McNamara and the Joint Chiefs of Staff, had set the stage for America's disaster in Vietnam. Epilogue. The Americanization of the Vietnam War between 1963 and 1965 was the product of an unusual interaction of personalities and circumstances. The escalation of U.S. military intervention grew out of a complicated chain of events and a complex web of decisions that slowly transformed the conflict in Vietnam into an American war. Much of the literature on Vietnam has argued that the Cold War mentality put such pressure on President Johnson that the Americanization of the war was inevitable. The imperative to contain communism was an important factor in Vietnam policy. But neither American entry into the war nor the manner in which the war was conducted was inevitable. The United States went to war in Vietnam in a manner unique in American history. Vietnam was not forced on the United States by a tidal wave of Cold War ideology. It slunk in on cat's feet. Between November 1963 and July 1965, LBJ made the critical decisions that took the United States into war almost without realizing it. The decisions and the way in which he made them profoundly affected the way the United States fought in Vietnam. Although impersonal forces, such as the ideological imperative of containing communism, the bureaucratic structure, and institutional priorities, influenced the president's Vietnam decisions, those decisions depended primarily on his character, his motivations, and his relationships with his principal advisors. Most investigations of how the United States entered the war have devoted little attention to the crucial developments which shaped LBJ's approach to Vietnam and set conditions for a gradual intervention. The first of several turning points in the American escalation comprised the near contemporaneous assassinations of Ngo Dinh Diem and John F. Kennedy. The legacy of the Kennedy administration included an expanded commitment to South Vietnam as an experiment in countering communist insurgencies, and a deep distrust of the military that manifested itself in the appointment of officers who would prove supportive of the administration's policies. After November 1963, the United States confronted what in many ways was a new war in South Vietnam. Having deposed the government of Ngo Dinh Diem and his brother Nu, and having supported actions that led to their deaths, Washington assumed responsibility for the new South Vietnamese leaders. Intensified Viet Cong activity added impetus to U.S. deliberations, leading Johnson and his advisors to conclude that the situation in South Vietnam demanded action beyond military advice and support. Next, in the spring of 1964, the Johnson administration adopted graduated pressure as its strategic concept for the Vietnam War. Rooted in Maxwell Taylor's national security strategy of flexible response, graduated pressure evolved over the next year, becoming the blueprint for the deepening American commitment to maintaining South Vietnam's independence. Then, in August 1964, in response to the Gulf of Tonkin incident, the United States crossed the threshold of direct American military action against North Vietnam. The Gulf of Tonkin resolution gave the president carte blanche for escalating the war. During the ostensibly benign holding period from September 1964 to February 1965, LBJ was preoccupied with his domestic political agenda, and McNamara built consensus behind graduated pressure. In early 1965, the president raised U.S. intervention to a higher level again, deciding on February 9th to begin a systematic program of limited airstrikes on targets in North Vietnam and, on February 26th, to commit U.S. ground forces to the south. Last, in March 1965, he quietly gave U.S. ground forces the mission of killing Viet Cong. That series of decisions, none in itself tantamount to a clearly discernible decision to go to war, nevertheless transformed America's commitment in Vietnam. Viewed together, those decisions might create the impression of a deliberate determination on the part of the Johnson administration to go to war. On the contrary, the president did not want to go to war in Vietnam and was not planning to do so. Indeed, as early as May 1964, LBJ seemed to realize that an American war in Vietnam would be a costly failure. He confided to McGeorge Bundy, "Looks to me like we're getting into another Korea. It just worries the hell out of me. I don't see what we can ever hope to get out of this." "It was," Johnson observed, "the biggest damn mess I ever saw. It's damn easy to get into a war, but it's going to be harder to ever extricate yourself if you get in." Despite his recognition that the situation in Vietnam demanded that he consider alternative courses of action and make a difficult decision, LBJ sought to avoid or to postpone indefinitely an explicit choice between war and disengagement from South Vietnam. In the ensuing months, however, each decision he made moved the United States closer to war, although he seemed not to recognize that fact. The president's fixation on short-term political goals, combined with his character and the personalities of his principal civilian and military advisors, rendered the administration incapable of dealing adequately with the complexities of the situation in Vietnam. LBJ's advisory system was structured to achieve consensus and to prevent potentially damaging leaks. Profoundly insecure and distrustful of anyone but his closest civilian advisors, the president viewed the JCS with suspicion. When the situation in Vietnam seemed to demand military action, Johnson did not turn to his military advisors to determine how to solve the problem. He turned instead to his civilian advisors to determine how to postpone a decision. The relationship between the president, the secretary of defense, and the joint chiefs led to the curious situation in which the nation went to war without the benefit of effective military advice from the organization having the statutory responsibility to be the nation's principal military advisors. What Johnson feared most in 1964 was losing his chance to win the presidency in his own right. He saw Vietnam principally as a danger to that goal. After the election, he feared that an American military response to the deteriorating situation in Vietnam would jeopardize chances that his Great Society would pass through Congress. The Great Society was to be Lyndon Johnson's great domestic political legacy, and he could not tolerate the risk of its failure. McNamara would help the president first protect his electoral chances and then pass the Great Society by offering a strategy for Vietnam that appeared cheap and could be conducted with minimal public and congressional attention. McNamara's strategy of graduated pressure permitted Johnson to pursue his objective of not losing the war in Vietnam while postponing the day of reckoning and keeping the whole question out of public debate all the while. McNamara was confident in his ability to satisfy the president's needs. He believed fervently that nuclear weapons and the Cold War international political environment had made traditional military experience and thinking not only irrelevant, but often dangerous for contemporary policy. Accordingly, McNamara, along with systems analysts and other civilian members of his own department and the Department of State, developed his own strategy for Vietnam. Bolstered by what he regarded as a personal triumph during the Cuban Missile Crisis, McNamara drew heavily on that experience and applied it to Vietnam. Based on the assumption that carefully controlled and sharply limited military actions were reversible and therefore could be carried out at minimal risk and cost, graduated pressure allowed McNamara and Johnson to avoid confronting many of the possible consequences of military action. Johnson and McNamara succeeded in creating the illusion that the decisions to attack North Vietnam were alternatives to war rather than war itself. Graduated pressure defined military action as a form of communication, the object of which was to affect the enemy's calculation of interests and dissuade him from a particular activity. Because the favored means of communication, bombing fixed installations and economic targets, were not appropriate for the mobile forces of the Viet Cong, who lacked an infrastructure and whose strength in the South was political as well as military, McNamara and his colleagues pointed to the infiltration of men and supplies into South Vietnam as proof that the source and center of the enemy's power in Vietnam lay north of the 17th parallel, and specifically in Hanoi. Their definition of the enemy's source of strength was derived from that strategy, rather than from a critical examination of the full reality in South Vietnam, and turned out to be inaccurate. Graduated pressure was fundamentally flawed in other ways. The strategy ignored the uncertainty of war and the unpredictable psychology of an activity that involves killing, death, and destruction. To the North Vietnamese, military action, involving as it did attacks on their forces and bombing of their territory, was not simply a means of communication. Human sacrifices in war evoke strong emotions, creating a dynamic that defies systems analysis quantification. Once the United States crossed the threshold of war against North Vietnam with covert raids and the Gulf of Tonkin reprisals, the future course of events depended not only on decisions made in Washington, but also on enemy responses and actions that were unpredictable. McNamara, however, viewed the war as another business management problem that, he assumed, would ultimately succumb to his reasoned judgment and others' rational calculations. He and his assistants thought that they could predict with great precision what amount of force applied in Vietnam would achieve the results they desired, and they believed that they could control that force with great precision from halfway around the world. There were compelling contemporaneous arguments that graduated pressure would not affect Hanoi's will sufficiently to convince the North to desist from its support of the South, and that such a strategy would probably lead to an escalation of the war. Others expressed doubts about the utility of attacking North Vietnam by air to win a conflict in South Vietnam. Nevertheless, McNamara refused to consider the consequences of his recommendations and forged ahead, oblivious of the human and psychological complexities of war. Despite their recognition that graduated pressure was fundamentally flawed, the JCS were unable to articulate effectively either their objections or alternatives. Inter-service rivalry was a significant impediment. Although differing perspectives were understandable given the chiefs' long experience in their own services and their need to protect the interests of their services, the president's principal military advisors were obligated by law to render their best advice. The chiefs' failure to do so and their willingness to present single-service remedies to a complex military problem prevented them from developing a comprehensive estimate of the situation or from thinking effectively about strategy. When it became clear to the chiefs that they were to have little influence on the policymaking process, they failed to confront the president with their objections to McNamara's approach to the war. Instead, they attempted to work within that strategy in order to remove over time the limitations to further action. Unable to develop a strategic alternative to graduated pressure, the chiefs became fixated on means by which the war could be conducted and pressed for an escalation of the war by degrees. They hoped that graduated pressure would evolve over time into a fundamentally different strategy, more in keeping with their belief in the necessity of greater force and its more resolute application. In so doing, they gave tacit approval to graduated pressure during the critical period in which the president escalated the war. They did not recommend the total force they believed would ultimately be required in Vietnam and accepted a strategy they knew would lead to a large but inadequate commitment of troops for an extended period of time with little hope for success. McNamara and Lyndon Johnson were far from disappointed with the Joint Chiefs' failings. Because his priorities were domestic, Johnson had little use for military advice that recommended actions inconsistent with those priorities. McNamara and his assistants in the Department of Defense, on the other hand, were arrogant. They disparaged military advice because they thought that their intelligence and analytical methods could compensate for their lack of military experience and education. Indeed, military experience seemed to them a liability because military officers took too narrow a view and based their advice on antiquated notions of war. Geopolitical and technological changes of the last 15 years, they believed, had rendered advice based on military experience irrelevant and, in fact, dangerous. McNamara's disregard for military experience and for history left him to draw principally on his staff in the Department of Defense, and led him to conclude that his only real experience with the planning and direction of military force, the Cuban Missile Crisis, was the most relevant analogy to Vietnam. While they slowly deepened American military involvement in Vietnam, Johnson and McNamara pushed the chiefs further away from the decision-making process. There was no meaningful structure through which the chiefs could voice their views. Even the chairman was not a reliable conduit. National Security Council meetings were strictly pro forma affairs in which the president endeavored to build consensus for decisions already made. Johnson continued Kennedy's practice of meeting with small groups of his most trusted advisors. Indeed, he made his most important decisions at the Tuesday lunch meetings in which Rusk, McGeorge Bundy, and McNamara were the only regular participants. The president and McNamara shifted responsibility for real planning away from the JCS to ad hoc committees composed principally of civilian analysts and attorneys, whose main goal was to obtain a consensus consistent with the president's pursuit of the middle ground between disengagement and war. The products of those efforts carried the undeserved credibility of proposals that had been agreed on by all departments and were therefore hard to oppose. McNamara and Johnson endeavored to get the advice they wanted by placing conditions and qualifications on questions that they asked the chiefs. When the chief's advice was not consistent with his own recommendations, McNamara, with the aid of the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, lied in meetings of the National Security Council about the chief's views. Rather than advice, McNamara and Johnson extracted from the JCS acquiescence and silent support for decisions already made. Even as they relegated the chiefs to a peripheral position in the policymaking process, they were careful to preserve the facade of consultation to prevent the JCS from opposing the administration's policies either openly or behind the scenes. As American involvement in the war escalated, Johnson's vulnerability to disaffected senior military officers increased because he was purposely deceiving the Congress and the public about the nature of the American military effort in Vietnam. The President and the Secretary of Defense deliberately obscured the nature of decisions made and left undefined the limits that they envisioned on the use of force. They indicated to the chiefs that they would take actions that they never intended to pursue. McNamara and his assistants, who considered communication the purpose of military action, kept the nature of their objective from the JCS, who viewed winning as the only viable goal in war. Finally, Johnson appealed directly to them, referring to himself as the coach and them as his team. To dampen their calls for further action, Lyndon Johnson attempted to generate sympathy from the JCS for the great pressures that he was feeling from those who opposed escalation. The ultimate test of the chief's loyalty came in July 1965. The administration's lies to the American public had grown in magnitude as the American effort in Vietnam escalated. The president's plan of deception depended on tacit approval or silence from the JCS. LBJ had misrepresented the mission of U.S. ground forces in Vietnam, distorted the views of the chiefs to lend credibility to his decision against mobilization, grossly understated the number of troops General Westmoreland had requested, and lied to the Congress about the monetary cost of actions already approved and those awaiting final decision. The chiefs did not disappoint the president. In the days before the president made his duplicitous public announcement concerning Westmoreland's request, the chiefs, with the exception of Commandant of the Marine Corps Green, withheld from congressmen their estimates of the amount of force that would be needed in Vietnam. As he had during the Gulf of Tonkin hearings, Wheeler lent his support to the president's deception of Congress. The five silent men on the Joint Chiefs made possible the way the United States went to war in Vietnam. Several factors kept the chiefs from challenging the president's subterfuges. The professional code of the military officer prohibits him or her from engaging in political activity, actions that could have undermined the administration's credibility and derailed its Vietnam policy could not have been undertaken lightly. The chiefs felt loyalty to their commander-in-chief. The Truman-MacArthur controversy during the Korean War had warned the chiefs about the dangers of overstepping the bounds of civilian control. Loyalty to their services also weighed against opposing the president and the Secretary of Defense. Harold Johnson, for example, decided against resignation because he thought he had to remain in office to protect the Army's interests as best he could. Admiral MacDonald and Marine Corps Commandant Green compromised their views on Vietnam in exchange for concessions to their respective services. Green achieved a dramatic expansion of the Marine Corps, and MacDonald ensured that the Navy retained control of Pacific Command. None of the chiefs had sworn an oath to his service, however. They had all sworn, rather, to support and defend the Constitution of the United States. General Green recalled that direct requests by congressmen for his assessment put him in a difficult situation. The president was lying, and he expected the chiefs to lie as well, or, at least, to withhold the whole truth. Although the president should not have placed the chiefs in that position, the flag officers should not have tolerated it when he had. Because the Constitution locates civilian control of the military in Congress as well as in the executive branch, the chiefs could not have been justified in deceiving the people's representatives about Vietnam. Wheeler, in particular, allowed his duty to the president to overwhelm his obligations under the Constitution. As cadets are taught at the United States Military Academy, the Joint Chiefs of Staff relationship with the Congress is challenging and demands that military officers possess a strong character and keen intellect. While the chiefs must present Congress with their best advice based on their professional experience and education, they must be careful not to undermine their credibility by crossing the line between advice and advocacy of service interests. Maxwell Taylor had a profound influence on the nature of the civil-military relationship during the escalation of American involvement in Vietnam. In contrast to Army Chief of Staff George C. Marshall, who at the start of World War II recognized the need for the JCS to suppress service parochialism, to provide advice consistent with national interests, Taylor exacerbated service differences to help McNamara and Johnson keep the chiefs divided and, thus, marginal to the policy process. Taylor recommended men for appointment to the JCS who were less likely than their predecessors to challenge the direction of the administration's military policy, even when they knew that that policy was fundamentally flawed. Taylor's behavior is perhaps best explained by his close personal friendship with the Kennedy family, McNamara, and later, Johnson. In contrast again to Marshall, who thought it important to keep a professional distance from President Franklin Roosevelt, Taylor abandoned an earlier view, similar to Marshall's, in favor of a belief that the JCS and the president should enjoy an intimate, easy relationship, born of friendship and mutual regard. The way in which the United States went to war in the period between November 1963 and July 1965 had, not surprisingly, a profound influence on the conduct of the war and on its outcome. Because Vietnam policy decisions were made based on domestic political expediency, and because the president was intent on forging a consensus position behind what he believed was a middle policy, the administration deliberately avoided clarifying its policy objectives and postponed discussing the level of force that the president was willing to commit to the effort. Indeed, because the president was seeking domestic political consensus, members of the administration believed that ambiguity in the objectives for fighting in Vietnam was a strength rather than a weakness. Determined to prevent dissent from the JCS, the administration concealed its development of fallback objectives. Over time, the maintenance of U.S. credibility quietly supplanted the stated policy objective of a free and independent South Vietnam. The principal civilian planners had determined that to guarantee American credibility, it was not necessary to win in Vietnam. That conclusion, combined with the belief that the use of force was merely another form of diplomatic communication, directed the military effort in the South at achieving stalemate rather than victory. Those charged with planning the war believed that it would be possible to preserve American credibility even if the United States Armed Forces withdrew from the South after a show of force against the North and in the South, in which American forces were bloodied. After the United States became committed to the war, however, and more American soldiers, airmen, and Marines had died in the conflict, it would become impossible simply to disengage and declare America's credibility intact, a fact that should have been foreseen. The chiefs sensed the shift in objectives, but did not challenge directly the views of civilian planners in that connection. McNamara and Johnson recognized that, once committed to war, the JCS would not agree to an objective other than imposing a solution on the enemy consistent with U.S. interests. The JCS deliberately avoided clarifying the objective as well. As a result, when the United States went to war, the JCS pursued objectives different from those of the president. When the chiefs requested permission to apply force consistent with their conception of U.S. objectives, the president and McNamara, based on their goals and domestic political constraints, rejected JCS requests or granted them only in part. The result was that the JCS and McNamara became fixated on the means rather than on the ends, and on the manner in which the war was conducted instead of a military strategy that could connect military actions to achievable policy goals. Because forthright communication between top civilian and military officials in the Johnson administration was never developed, there was no reconciliation of McNamara's intention to limit the American military effort sharply, and the chief's assessment that the United States could not possibly win under such conditions. If they had attempted to reconcile those positions, they could not have helped but recognize the futility of the American war effort. The Joint Chiefs of Staff became accomplices in the president's deception and focused on a tactical task, killing the enemy. General Westmoreland's strategy of attrition in South Vietnam was, in essence, the absence of a strategy. The result was military activity, bombing North Vietnam and killing the enemy in South Vietnam, that did not aim to achieve a clearly defined objective. It was unclear how quantitative measures by which McNamara interpreted the success and failure of the use of military force were contributing to an end of the war. As American casualties mounted and the futility of the strategy became apparent, the American public lost faith in the effort. The chiefs did not request the number of troops they believed necessary to impose a military solution in South Vietnam until after the Tet Offensive in 1968. By that time, however, the president was besieged by opposition to the war and was unable even to consider the request. LBJ, who had gone to such great lengths to ensure a crushing defeat over Barry Goldwater in 1964, declared that he was withdrawing from the race for his party's presidential nomination. Johnson thought that he would be able to control the U.S. involvement in Vietnam. That belief, based on the strategy of graduated pressure and McNamara's confident assurances, proved in dramatic fashion to be false. If the president was surprised by the consequences of his decisions between November 1963 to July 1965, he should not have been so. He had disregarded the advice he did not want to hear in favor of a policy based on the pursuit of his own political fortunes and his beloved domestic programs. The war in Vietnam was not lost in the field, nor was it lost on the front pages of the New York Times or on the college campuses. It was lost in Washington, D.C., even before Americans assumed sole responsibility for the fighting in 1965, and before they realized the country was at war. Indeed, even before the first American units were deployed. The disaster in Vietnam was not the result of impersonal forces, but a uniquely human failure, the responsibility for which was shared by President Johnson and his principal military and civilian advisors. The failings were many and reinforcing. Arrogance, weakness, lying in the pursuit of self-interest, and, above all, the abdication of responsibility to the American people. This is H.R. McMaster. This production of Dereliction of Duty, Lyndon Johnson, Robert McNamara, the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and the Lies That Led to Vietnam, presented by HarperCollins and Harper Audio, was directed by John Renette and recorded at JEL Recording in Newport Beach, California. Engineered by Mark Smaniato, it was produced by Common Mode. Paul Fowley, Technical Director. Executive Producer, Suzanne Franco Mitchell. Text copyright, 1997, by H.R. McMaster. Production copyright, 2018, by HarperCollins Publishers. All rights reserved. Thank you for listening.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.